Welcome to episode 38 of the Walk and Talk podcast. I'm Greg Johnson, and today is Friday, August 28th, 2020. The topic for this episode is going to be fairly specific, but it will have broad application and hopefully long-term value and applicability. So the topic is what to do in the specific case of the fall 2020 class of students coming to the campus of the University of Iowa, and some of those students are arriving and are finding themselves to be infected with the COVID-19 virus. Although the specific topic I'm going to be discussing is the quarantine or isolation areas on campus at the University of Iowa for students infected with COVID-19. That's the specific topic for this episode, but the connected and peripheral issues are regarding online education and how to respond to fluctuations in the pandemic locally that are kind of hard to predict. So we can't just, you know, build a 100-room quarantine facility and then suddenly need 200 rooms, or spend the money for 100 rooms, but it turns out we only needed 50. It's hard to have a scalable and responsive resource like that. Not impossible, as I'll discuss, but it's a challenge. So anyway, I'll talk a little bit about online training and some solutions that can be offered to address these issues. So the policy at the university has been to isolate those who have the COVID virus, and that sort of makes sense. That's what people are doing across the country. If they are infected, they will stay home and stay isolated in a room of the house or in the basement or something like that. So the approach to managing the COVID infections seems to make sense. The challenge, of course, is that students cannot quarantine in their own dorm rooms if they have a roommate or two or three other roommates. And similarly, you know, if there are places on campus where the housing is provided by non-university affiliates, just apartment buildings around Iowa City, that becomes a problem. I think that the university is primarily focused on students who are otherwise dependent upon university housing. So a problem has come up that was highlighted first by one of the students who'd been asked to go to the quarantine facility. It's an isolation facility, and the student was writing about the experience of being asked to sort of immediately leave their dorm and go to this isolation facility without really anyone helping them to get their things moved in a short matter of time. And then the facility itself seemed to be very inadequate and not very clean and not very appealing. As somebody who has worked at the University of Iowa in a half a dozen different departments and colleges all over campus, over the past 30 years, I have always tried to be very positive and appreciative and supportive of students. And also, you know, during that time of year when students and parents are on campus, you always want to be very welcoming. And certainly welcoming to anybody who's new to your community, whether they're a student or not. But, you know, these are folks who are coming to Iowa City, and they're not just driving through and stopping at a convenience store to get a slushie. They're making a big commitment to spend 4 years or more in this city and to spend collectively hundreds of millions of dollars on sports and probably hundreds of millions of dollars on restaurants and bars and at shops and whatever. So obviously life isn't all about the cha-ching, the money and such, but one does want to be appreciative of those who help keep their community and institution running. So with new students, it's a great opportunity to make a really good impression, you know, and particularly an even heightened opportunity when somebody is sick or their computer's broken or whatever. When somebody's in a crisis, you have this opportunity to say, hey, it's okay, let's take care of this, you know, in a very thoughtful way. And in the example of the students who are finding themselves infected with COVID, what we would probably try to do is provide them with some exceptional care and very high quality environment, so that what would otherwise be really kind of a negative experience could be turned around into something of a positive. And we need to take care of, you know, all the students, but particularly those who are sick or finding themselves in other unfortunate situations. So what's really too bad is that this opportunity to shine has turned into a bit of a media crisis for the university, because the students are having sort of the opposite experience. Poor facilities, people not being helpful, and being put in isolation. And presumably, there's this complication of, do we want to be super transparent and informative regarding who is getting sick and, you know, showing pictures of the facilities? Or, you know, is that a violation of people's healthcare information privacy, the HIPAA guidelines? So there tends to generally be a concern about releasing any sort of health information. And to the extent that people being sick on campus is a demotivator, you know, for people wanting to come here, it's bad PR. We don't want, you know, the image of the University of Iowa to be sick people. So, you know, maybe there's an attempt to sort of play that down or cover that up a little bit, etc. But if you look at the university hospitals and clinics as an example, and the new hospital that is the children's hospital, that has had a lot of really positive PR. And there's been, you know, a lot in the media about it. And it's just exceptional quality facility with excellent staff, etc. So what one would hope would be that there would be this similar, very positive experience for students getting sick. Now, the problem, if we should go ahead and make a comparison, the problem is with a brand new children's hospital, you know, that's not just like a pop-up store. I mean, that's a permanent infrastructure. You have the building, you have administrators, staff, and an ongoing, unending need for healthcare. And so there's an easy, you know, roadmap for that. Okay. But with something like a pandemic, one does not know the extent to which the demand will be there. If you're going to build a department of COVID quarantine and isolation services, how many beds would be provided by that facility? And would those be private rooms because of concerns about spreading? Would the facility need special air handling, or could existing buildings be used? My sense is that a lot of the buildings on campus and in Iowa City, it may be a hotel, the air handling is such that there might be some mixing of air. And so a person would not want that going on. You don't want to be spreading infection in a facility designed to reduce the spreading of infection. So first of all, you know, it's important to just acknowledge that, yes, indeed, we need the following: funding for a COVID response department, office space and staffing for that. People need to be going there. It can't be some extra responsibility that you lay on top of already overextended and underpaid and overburdened staff members or faculty. No, it has to be full-time people who are doing this, and they have to be okay with the idea that we don't know when this is going to be over. So, you know, it's people that are going to take a job, and we don't know if this is going to kind of fizzle out in 6 months or a year, but hopefully, certainly, it wouldn't go for 10 years or something. So this is kind of a short-term need, but it needs to have the infrastructure as if it was a long-term need. So specially trained staff, specially skilled and experienced administrators, specially designed infrastructure, perhaps the opportunity cost of using the hospital for that is just too excessive. I presume it is that, you know, most people are not asked to stay at the hospital if they don't have some specific healthcare need. If they need to quarantine, they're asked to go home. And it's just a problem in dorm rooms because those are more likely to transmit. Okay, and so there is a need for what I just outlined. The concerns and complaints are legitimate and really need to be addressed in the form of simply just, you know, an apology, number one, and then a response that provides the services that are reasonably to be expected. So there definitely needs to be that response. So in what I'm sharing, I don't intend to be, you know, diminishing the concerns or explaining and justifying this somehow. That's not what this is about, but it's just that, you know, to acknowledge the complexity of it, and that businesses and universities and hospitals, you know, they all have long-term plans. You go to a bank and you lay out a business plan and you say, oh, this is what's expected in 5 years, 10 years, etc. And then the bank signs off on it and says, okay, that sounds like something we'd be willing to put some money into. But if you go to the bank and you say, I don't know what the demand's going to be, it could fluctuate, and I don't know how long this is going to go for, and, you know, etc. Well, the bank's not going to be very interested in that. The bank needs to know that there's going to be kind of an ongoing demand for whatever product or service this is that you're offering. So the university is in that little bit of a conundrum, which is they don't know how many cases they're going to be, and that may fluctuate. And because it's not easily scalable, because we're talking about physical infrastructure, they can't build on another 50 rooms to their COVID response department. That takes time, at least a year or years, to build a facility. So there's no way to do that. Perhaps one of the existing buildings on campus could be retrofitted to serve this purpose, but that also takes some expense. And, you know, the other challenge is that if you look at a large institution like the University of Iowa and the academic side, the sports side, the healthcare side, etc., there are these different departments that specialize in what they do. And when I say specialize, that's a number of things, but it's that, you know, the staff there have been working and having experience in that area of specialty for years. So there is the individual experience that accumulates and improves, and then there is also the experience collectively of a department and institutional memory. So each department is specialized in what it does. If there were to be a COVID response department that offered, among other things, you know, information, but also the quarantine and isolation areas, etc., that department would need to draw from multiple disciplines. There would obviously need to be healthcare professionals involved with that. There would need to be custodial staff, not the existing custodial staff, but specially trained custodial staff. And again, one can't just say, oh, well, let's just push this responsibility onto existing staff. That just doesn't work. It's not responsible and is not really respectful or ethical. So one needs to hire new staff full-time, and they would come from food service, from hospitality, from a variety of different disciplines and departments on campus to form this new department. Now, that's not to say it can't be done, but it's just to point out that it needs to be done, and it's challenging to do, and we might need additional funding from the state or from some other source to do that. Some simple options might be to give students a voucher and request that they be as responsible as possible, but give them a voucher that would work to pay for a local hotel so they could self-isolate in a hotel, not in a dorm room, and that would allow them to have minimal interactions with others. Perhaps have some sort of food service arrangement so they could get food, and maybe the university could pay for an entire floor in one of the hotels, perhaps out in Coralville. There are some of these hotels that look like they're not consistently at 90% occupancy. I'm just going to graciously say that. I mean, I'm guessing that they have maybe 3 or 4 or 5 floors that are empty. But regardless, the university could develop a relationship with some of the hotels in the area. And as long as the air handling system in those hotels would not be spreading air and infection to other hotel guests, then that might be a solution. So there's some scalable infrastructure. There may be a need to have some university staff present. Perhaps essentially one could create a virtual scalable dormitory that is specifically designed to address and support the needs of those who are infected with COVID. And, you know, each person there could essentially be tracked in terms of when did they get infected, and if they're going to be there for 2 weeks, when is that period of 2 weeks up? And people from hospitality at the university could help with managing the expected load and demand on that. But that would be better than just sending people out to hotels with these vouchers. And that might be a solution. There are quite a few spaces available in the Iowa City area where that could be done. But otherwise, I think part of what happens in larger institutions is that there are challenges that arise where people look around and honestly and accurately say, well, that's not my responsibility. That's not my department. You know, there's this sense that people are already overworked. They have a job description and they don't want to be burdened with tasks outside of their job description. And so they say, you know, that really belongs over at the hospital. And the hospital says, well, that's really more of a dormitory issue. And the, you know, dorms say, well, we're inadequate to handle this. That really needs to be, you know, handled over here, over there. So, you know, big institution, everybody has their job responsibilities, and nobody really is specifically tasked with addressing challenges like this. So that's part of the problem. But I think overall, just to summarize, is that, you know, an apology does not cost a lot. An apology does not require hiring administrators or building facilities or making arrangements with community partners. You know, apologies can come quickly, And I believe there was some sort of an apology issued from the university. But then apologies, to be sincere and to be impactful, need to be followed up with action that is to correct for problems and prevent future problems. So that's really a more complete apology, and the university really should get busy with determining what is going to be done to correct these issues, because this is something that is going to continue happening into the sort of near future. Week after week, there will be more cases, and certainly creating a dorm environment where COVID could be spreading among roommates and at parties and such, the university is going to want to make sure they're not perceived as being liable or responsible for people getting sick and any sort of losses or problems beyond that. So in so doing, the university is going to want to take every possible measure they can to ensure the safety of all students and people of the university community. There's a difficult balance in knowing how to handle these kinds of situations. As the person who would be put through the ringer and having this horrible experience of being kicked out of their dorm and sent to some unpleasant isolation area, that person who has been paying to have a nice experience on campus, they have, you know, every right to be frustrated and voice their concerns. And yet, you know, at the same time, higher education is under attack. It is being defunded at the rate of hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's hard for higher education institutions that are stretched thin to deliver the quality that one would hope and expect. And that's not to excuse it. That's not to say, hey, you know, just put up with this inconvenience. But we want to kind of balance our frustration about things with the acknowledgement of the challenges that higher education institutions face. I want to talk a little bit about online training. That's been adopted by many K-12 and higher ed institutions for the purpose of reducing interaction and exposure and the spread of the COVID virus. Part of the on-campus experience that's so valuable is the ability to walk across campus and randomly see some friends or classmates and start up a discussion and then find out about a movie that's showing on campus, or having some people ask you to go out and get something to eat for lunch, or maybe there's a party going on over the weekend that people are looking forward to. So there are lots of these spontaneous, impromptu interactions, and that's lost when you go online. So it's hard to put a, you know, dollar value on that, or to say that, oh, that's, you know, worth X number of dollars, and so, you know, the cost of a course should now be $50 less because it's not on campus. That's all very difficult. These are abstract additional values of being on campus. But certainly there is that difference. And being in a classroom, being able to have eye contact with everybody, easily split out into groups, and then, you know, at the same time, go back into a full class presentation. That can be done with online video conferencing, but it's just not the same. And we know that a big part of communication is body language and facial expressions and other things that sometimes don't quite make it through a video camera and online interaction. And so that's why many people are expressing concern about the importance of not shutting down in-person classes in K-12 and higher ed. But that's a a debate that's going back and forth. And some people have suggested, and perhaps inaccurately, that an online experience with the University of Iowa is not much different than an online experience with Phoenix University or Hamilton College or some other, you know, online training experience. I'm not currently at the University of Iowa working there, but over a period of 30 years, I worked at the university in a variety of departments and capacities, and had an opportunity to work in the College of Liberal Arts, but also at the College of Law, at the hospitals and clinics, and in different departments on campus. I helped to teach a little bit through continuing education as sort of like a teaching assistant and tech support person for a course there. So I have this unique experience, I guess, of having been in different places and departments on campus and had an insight into that. So with the experience through continuing education, I was fascinated to learn that there are a lot of people who start their University of Iowa experience online as people who've already graduated, who may be working full-time. Maybe they have a business or some other full-time career that they are involved in, but they want to get some further education. So they'll go through this program of continuing education. And these courses, years ago, before the most recent Zoom interest and increase in online training, the continuing education group there was offering video, interactive video, and exams, and everything would be provided remotely. And even colleagues that I worked with were part of providing home study education. So tests would get mailed out and students would mail them back. So there have been a lot of efforts and opportunities for distance education. I found that some of the resistance to distance education came from within the university among traditionalists who felt that online courses and online training sort of diminished the character and the quality of education. And perhaps there's something to that, that in people's minds, if they've been through, you know, the brick and mortar campus experience and went to a well-established higher ed institution, they're going to think differently about some university like Phoenix University, where the courses are online and maybe the instructors are perhaps not as experienced. It depends. You know, a lot of these community colleges and technical colleges and vocational colleges are stigmatized. But if you drill down a little bit and do some research, you'll find out that there are some very skilled and experienced and exceptional business people who teach in those institutions, and maybe that's online. And so I think that some of that stigmatization of online training is really a little bit of that is just some posturing and maybe ego, and also trying to preserve a sense of superiority where maybe it's not earned or deserved. So many years ago, I was advocating for distance education and online training, and part of the reason for that was that seeing how higher education is always stretched in terms of not having enough classrooms, not having enough students paying tuition and being, you know, limited financially, etc., I thought that distance education and online training would be a more scalable way to offer education, to increase enrollment class sizes, and to make education more accessible, and to bring the cost of education down a little bit. So it seemed like there were a lot of positives for that kind of delivery of education, and it needs to be refined over time. So the tools to deliver it would get better and better. People's skill sets with using those tools would get better and better, and the overall experience for instructors and students would improve. But yeah, as I say, there's still some resistance to that, and there's still some confusion about the quality and value of education depending on how it's being delivered. So when the consideration arose of having classes completely online this fall of 2020, I guess the decision was made by the president to have students return to campus and use their own judgment based on their own personal sense of what they felt safe with. You know, certainly everybody wanting to be wearing masks, but keeping a distance, not going to parties, and we continue to hear this as a message from university leadership. So it's hard, though, to control people, and there certainly are those who do not believe in masks or believe it's an infringement on their freedom to party. And so that's a challenge. But that was the original thinking, that some students could come on campus and others, if they wanted to, could perhaps engage in more of the online experience. And then it was discussed regarding the return from Thanksgiving break, which would happen in November. There was some concern that, you know, people going back home and then coming back to campus would just be inviting some trouble, and it would only be for the remaining, you know, 4 weeks or 5 weeks or whatever would be left of the semester. So why not just have people stay home and finish out the semester online? I think the concern of the university probably is that how do we justify charging these high tuition rates and yet provide the education online? The assumption is that the high tuition helps cover the cost of maintaining all these campus buildings and maintaining the campus, etc. And that if we don't have to maintain the campus, if everybody's, you know, taking classes online, well, then we shouldn't have to charge so much in tuition. And it's that people at the university even they believe that somehow the quality of education is diminished when it's delivered online and maybe has less value. And it's this squeamishness and posturing and sort of sheepish response. And I think that's all unfortunate and misguided, because really there are still costs associated with online education. And the buildings are not going to, they're not on a month-by-month lease or something. You know, we can't just suddenly not have the expense of having an entire campus. That expense is still going to be there. And there is a core campus anyway, just to maintain the university, just the kind of administrative side of that. And there would be reason for people to be on campus conducting their academic business, you know. So it's not like suddenly the need for a campus disappears if you're doing things online. So that's number one. And to a certain degree, classes could be even more impactful if there could be more money diverted to the education side and less to the infrastructure side. So the same money is needed, but it's being spent in different ways. Let's just take, for example, licensing. And I'm not currently up specifically on all the details of the licensing, but, you know, if we're going to be offering Microsoft Office 365 licenses to every student on campus and off campus. You know, there's an expense to that. And some of these licenses actually are IP-based. So software is available for people to use on campus, but once they're identified as not being on campus, the license doesn't qualify. That could be for, you know, maybe lynda.com, some of these online training tools or what have you, but that's an issue. And so an institution can pay more to have the license available outside of the .edu domain, campus, etc. That's available, but it costs more. So, you know, the people that don't understand that, and I'm not talking about the students or their parents, I'm talking about administrators and educators, maybe just don't realize that there can be equal value or greater value to online training. It's more flexible, certainly. It's more scalable. If you suddenly have a surge of interest in a certain class, you don't have to, you know, cut it off at 30 students or something. You just say, hey, let's have a bigger class. It allows for some of the endangered lesser taught languages or whatever, these courses that have five students, that somebody's looking at that and saying, oh, let's scratch that off the list of available courses because it's not, you know, a lecture hall of 500 people. I remember helping with a distance education course that involved three different top 10 university institutions collaborating, working together so that, you know, any one institution looking at the interest and the enrollment for that class, any one institution would have looked at that and said, let's scrap it. But it was really valuable, you know. It's sort of like, you know, not too many people are taking courses in brain surgery, but you don't say, oh, there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in brain surgery, so let's just scrap it. There are these courses that have low enrollment but have high value. So online training makes it possible to have partnerships with other higher ed institutions and also have some probably what feels like less encroaching, less threatening partnerships between state-run colleges and private colleges and community colleges. Those kinds of collaborative partnerships are what will be needed going forward into the future in an environment where state institutions are cutting funding by hundreds of millions of dollars. There needs to be a support network that raises up the social, societal, you know, belief that higher education is of value and is important. And there are certain people who I won't name in this podcast episode, but people who are high up in government who belittle and degrade and stigmatize higher education and claim that it's, you know, mostly being used to manipulate young people's minds, etc. So, you know, there's that misinformation out there. And so there are a lot of battles that need to be fought on the part of higher education. And whatever tools can be used and whatever partnerships can be formed that could help facilitate healthy and available and economically available education, that's to be valued. At some point after the COVID pandemic passes, there's still a need. We know there is still a need for access to higher education in rural areas. There's a need for healthcare in rural areas. There are a lot of needs in rural areas that are well served by these satellite offices. You know, you'll see a small branch office of a bank. You'll see a small branch office of a hospital that maybe is based in, you know, Iowa City, but then they have these small satellite offices. So the same is true. You see this typically with community colleges where they'll have mini campuses all over the state. And that makes education more readily available. A student can live at home, continue working if their family has a farming operation, they could continue working at home, helping with the family farm, and then also go to the mini campus and get additional training in some particular vocation they're interested in. And as these higher education institutions support one another, that helps, you know, it's the rising tide that raises all boats rise with the rising tide. I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. But the point is, yeah, as we help one another, we all get better, you know? So anyway, I think that the University of Iowa shouldn't completely abandon the idea of an on-campus experience, because that would be disruptive and traumatic to instructors and students and families who really believe in that. But to the extent there's a new generation of people and instructors who are embracing these technologies and opportunities, I think the University of Iowa would be well postured to go ahead and support those initiatives. There are instructors that I've worked with who years ago were having their class, their students were meeting up with another class on the same topic over Skype, and that other class might be thousands of miles away in another country. So there was distance education going on long before the pandemic. And for students in those classes, you would just have to be there, but you could tell they were more engaged, more excited, more interested, more attentive, because there's this media experience and they're connecting with people that could, there's no way they could physically be there. They're in another country, you know? And so there's an aspect to online learning, even if it's hybrid, where there's some online and some in person. There's an aspect to that that's just really powerful, really effective, and really more impactful and more valuable. In non-COVID times, I suppose that a hybrid model with kind of an equal balance of online and in-person would be fine. There's this sort of term that people use that was popular for a while about flipping the classroom, where, you know, the kind of online presentation was given and then the classroom was less for lecturing and more for interaction and discussing what was learned. That was the flipping of the classroom idea. But that can certainly be done online. And anyway, I'll get off that soapbox. But basically, I think that, you know, there could be a considerable reduction in the exposure and spread with COVID-19 if, let's say, a hybrid model was used where students are in the class once a week, still getting face-to-face, still getting on campus, still experiencing that, but, you know, reducing by 80% the chance that somebody's going to get infected and slowing the spread of COVID-19. Obviously, we could put everybody in a little plastic bubble and then nobody'd get infected. So, but there are challenges with that, right? So, you know, by considerably reducing interactions and strongly encouraging safe measures, a lot can be accomplished. And it doesn't necessarily then have to be a matter of, you know, everybody's going home and doing things online, or everything's going to be 100% in the classroom. There can be these, you know, dial it in and dial it back, and that can be done fairly dynamically. I'm still helping some instructors in the air classroom preparation and using the online tools. And so something that does come up is, what do you do when you were planning on having a class on Wednesday or Thursday or whatever on campus, and suddenly it becomes apparent that, you know, a considerable number of people in the class are infected, or there's been a administrative decision to not have classes in person that week because of the spread or whatever. So you want to be pretty quick at being able to shift to the online model. So it does help to have that in place and up and going. Even if you're planning on meeting in the classroom, you could tell your students, hey, let's everybody try to do an online meeting once a week. And the reason for that is that we need to confirm that everyone has access to the technology needed for online education. And just having a laptop computer that has a built-in webcam and microphone, that's not necessarily a guarantee that it's going to work. There can be these technical issues that people run into when they're trying to do an online meeting, you know. So it helps to have those run-throughs to ensure that everybody's able to participate before there's some sort of crisis and suddenly it's a requirement that everybody go online. That gives you time to provide the tech support needed and whatever resources for people who might need help. But yeah, I think the university, regarding the need for some isolation or quarantine for students, the university really should try to tackle that. And I'm sure it's difficult, you know, coming from the summer when a lot of people were gone, suddenly having to just create out of thin air some infrastructure to handle this. It's probably challenging, probably was, you know, pushed onto somebody who already had a lot of work to do. And maybe that person was sick for a couple of weeks and, you know, everybody's spread thin. But what would need to happen are the things I outlined earlier in this podcast episode, that there needs to be some kind of pop-up facility and a little bit of emergency funding, even if it's for taking some hotel rooms, like one or two floors at a hotel, and having some staff present, maybe having one room for the staff or sort of like a hall monitor. And that really should be done, and probably have some nice little snacks and things available for people just to kind of keep everybody happy and feeling appreciated and valued, and because they are. And so that should be done. And that may involve also some help from the community, because certainly the community's impacted when Iowa City and Johnson County are suddenly flagged as, the last I read is that as of today and this episode, we are like a global hotspot for COVID. And it really shouldn't be that way. I mean, we have a world-renowned healthcare hospital. We have some of the smartest people around. And so how is it that the smartest people around with the best healthcare resources available are suddenly failing on a global level with this? That doesn't add up. But anyway, yeah, it's not the kind of PR we want for our community or for our institutions. So because everybody's impacted by this, maybe there are people who would want to donate some money or volunteer some time to help with this, you know, project and help welcome these new short-term residents, some of whom will always inevitably become long-term permanent residents of our area. We definitely want to show people the red carpet and to have that awareness of how well we're treating people. We want that to be spread far and wide. We don't want to get a reputation as, you know, Iowa inconsiderate, but Iowa nice, right? So I think that's about everything I could share on this topic. I was just prompted to share this episode today because I'm reading a lot over the past few days of the ongoing discussion about the students who have had a bad experience and talk about, you know, what can be done to correct that and improve it. So I thought I would add these ideas and comments to that discussion. And, you know, overall, the overarching message is that educational institutions, businesses, nonprofit organizations, or whatever, are sometimes faced with unexpected challenges for which the staff and resources are not readily available. And so they need to be able to respond quickly. And even to the extent of communicating out with transparency to say, hey, look, we're not prepared for this. Be expected for some unpleasantries. Be expecting that. We're going to try to do the best we can, but here are the dozen problems we're facing in delivering the deliverables that we would like, and please bear with us. Well, somebody having a bad experience when they're told they're going to have a bad experience is not shocked, you know? But somebody having a bad experience when they were expecting a good experience, that person's upset and feeling misled, and, you know, there's all kinds of problems there. So anyway, this podcast episode, even though it's dealing with something that is a local issue, probably that won't be discussed much beyond another week, it's an issue that is everywhere in the world, and it's an issue that's always going to be resurfacing as big organizations and institutions are facing unexpected challenges. So hopefully some of the ideas shared will be thought-provoking and help in the preventative and proactive planning that groups are working on. Well, thanks for listening to this episode. I appreciate all of the likes and the subscribes or follows and the comments and shares, and I look forward to sharing more with you again soon. Take care.